Hi, this is Circulating Ideas, the Librarian Interview Podcast. I'm your host, Steve Thomas. My guest today is Kate Sheehan. Kate is the Open Source Implementation Coordinator for Bibliomation, a consortium of public and school libraries in Connecticut. When she's not coordinating, she blogs at loosecanonlibrarian.net and ALA TechSource. You can follow her on Twitter at @itsjustkate. You don't seem like a loose cannon librarian, but that's the name of your site. Can you tell me how you came up with the name for your site?
Oh, God, I just like alliteration. No, I named that site so long ago. It was sort of a joke with myself. You know, I think a lot of people starting websites and starting little blogs, you know, you don't think anyone's ever going to read your stupid blog. So I was like, haha, this is funny just to me. Like, it's funny in my head. I had found when I was first working in libraries, I'm not especially like loose cannon-y. I'm not like, a high risk person or anything like that. I'm pretty, reasonable,
right.
I think I'm reasonable. I definitely found early on in libraries, I'd be like, hey, you know, it'd be a neat idea. We should do, and it would just, you know, stuff that just seemed kind of to me like, let's try circulating. This is, you know, way back. Let's try a podcast. Let's try circulating MP3 players. Let's do whatever. Like, I mean, just sort of stuff that seemed like I didn't think it was a big deal. And people would be like, Kate, we need to really consider this, and we have to talk about the security, and we have to. And part of it was that I was new, and I wasn't necessarily thinking through all the like implications of the practical, like, you know, if you circulate MP3 players, you know, how are you going to have security on them? How are you, you know, what are you going to put on them? You know, is that legal with copyright and blah, blah? You know, I was brand new.
Right. You're just the passion of the new librarians.
Right. Like, this would be a cool idea. But I also wasn't necessarily saying, you know, I wasn't necessarily saying that wasn't important. I was just like, we should float. To me, it just makes sense to float a lot of ideas and see what sticks. It's not that I got shot down a lot. It was just that like people sort of acted like, whoa, slow down there with this craziness. And I was, and you know, to me, I'm like, this isn't that weird. And so I just thought like, only in this world am I like a crazy person. Only in this world am I, you know, woo, Kate Loose Cannon, you know? I've never actually been called a loose cannon, but it was definitely, it was mostly just a, sort of a joke with myself about the sort of culture around libraries that's very cautious. And I'm a pretty cautious person. And so within this culture, I'm not remotely cautious. And so it sort of cracked me up because I'm not incautious at all.
But in comparison with other librarians.
Right. And I was telling somebody I used to work with who sort of does financy stuff. We were talking about being, I think, detail oriented. And I said, you know, on the scale of detail orientedness, you know, I do okay. I'm pretty detail oriented enough. On the scale of librarian detail orientedness, like, forget it. You know, like I cannot keep up with some of my colleagues on that, you know, because it's just a different scale. And that's
right.
In essence.
I always say a good librarian has a little bit of OCD in them.
yeah, exactly. And you know, my husband likes to tease me about this at our gym. I get really, really, really annoyed that people don't put the free weights, the dumbbells back in their appropriate slots because it's annoying and it messes everything up. And also, as I have pointed out to him several times, both the rack and the weight have the number on them. It doesn't, you don't even have to know where, like, you don't have to be able to read. You don't have to know what the numbers mean. You just have to match the little symbols.
So do you actually go and reshelve at your gym?
I totally do. I totally do. And I realize that for the rest of the world, that makes me maybe a little bit OCD, but for librarians, that's nothing, you know?
Yeah, that's like whenever I walk through a bookstore, I'm always straightening little piles and putting things out right.
Yes.
My wife hates going to bookstores, because I used to work in bookstores, now I work in libraries, and it's just the most horrible combination.
Right, so you can't leave it untouched. No, I'm totally with you. It's I do the same thing. I neaten them, and I belly in restaurants when I was a kid. The weight thing really bothers me because I like if I need to put the ones I have back and now you've, you know, I have 15 pound weights and you've put the 30 pound weights in there and maybe it's some kind of, you're putting them together in some sort of mathematically interesting way, but you know, this is annoying because I'm not going to put my 15 pound weights back in the 30 pound spot. Like it's, I can't do it.
You're using LC classification. I'm trying to use Dewey. Come on.
Yeah. Yeah. So, And my husband thinks it's hysterical. He's like, "Hey, she and weight librarian," and I think the people at my gym think I'm a little, because I grumble about it while I do it. Like I won't do it just without being I won't do it and with out of the goodness of my heart. I'm annoyed the entire time. I'm like, "Oh, you don't even just match the little symbols." moving weights around.
So in your current job is the. I don't get this wrong. Open source implementation coordinator.
Yes, that is my very long title. Yes.
And yeah. So, what can you explain? Sort of what that is. What you do on a day to day basis in that kind of job.
Yeah. It's I was hired by Bibliomation. I'm trying to think with the timing of this. I was hired almost, it was almost 2 years ago. It'll be 2 years in November. To work with their open source. Project. We're a mix of school and public libraries, and we're the biggest consortium in Connecticut, and they were on Horizon, Cersei Dynex Horizon, and they started on Horizon in 2004, and then shortly thereafter, Cersei Dynex merged, and then they pulled the plug on Horizon.
Right.
So because they had just recently been through looking for a new system, it was sort of they knew what they wanted, and they knew that, most systems aren't really designed for consortia, so all the workarounds have to be put into place and blah, blah. And so they sort of knew, like, we wanted this one, you know? And that was right around the time, you know, people started talking about Koha and Evergreen shortly thereafter. And so they started looking at open source systems and... Brendan Gallagher, who runs Bywater Solutions, he's the president of Bywater Solutions, worked at Biblio at the time, and he was doing all the software stuff and you know, a lot of the testing, and then he his then fiance had moved to California, so of course he moved, and they were really sad. Brendan's great. And also they were sort of like, oh, we were kind of depending on this software person to do a lot of this, to support open source and the implementation of open source and all that. So they hired a new software coordinator. And around this time is when they also had started testing Evergreen. Because when they went to, again, this is way back, they went to LibLime to find out about what it would take to make Koha work for the consortium the way they needed it to work, isn't to say that Koha doesn't work for consortia, and I think actually it probably works better now than it did in 2005 or whatever, but it just in terms of what they needed for resource sharing, right. There's every consortia lives their lives differently, so and the development costs were just way, way high, more than they could afford. So then they really started testing Evergreen in earnest, and out of the box, it did a lot of the stuff that they needed it to do. And that's around when Brendan moved to California, and they sort of stopped and said, okay, what do we really need here? If we do open source, we don't necessarily need to spend our money on, the money that we would normally spend on a vendor, we would need to spend it on people, which is sort of the whole freeze and kittens thing. So they made a team where Melissa LaFave is our project manager and Benjamin Shum is our software coordinator. So he does all the software-y stuff. There's a lot of like, hey, Ben, can you write me a SQL for this? Because we all had SQL training and we can all modify SQLs and probably write them on but Ben will stand there and be like, okay, select star equal, you're just like off the top of his head, he'll just tell you what to type. Whereas the rest of us have to go and look it up and make sure we get it and, form our report correctly and everything. So we're constantly haranguing Ben to write us sequels. And then they hired me to do training and handholding and sort of front lines. I spend a lot of time at our libraries, less so lately, but when we first were in the project, and I'll be back in the libraries again in the fall a bit. At the time, Evergreen didn't have an acquisitions module yet. We didn't want to roll it out for our libraries right away, and you know, they're flying on the horizon. It's just that at some point that was going to go away. So what they decided to do is do a pilot project with, originally it was supposed to be three tiny libraries, it ended up being nine, as sort of a mini consortium on Evergreen, and it let us sort of cut our teeth on it. And this is around the time I was hired, when they had some small libraries on board. And the idea was to sort of have this baby consortium where we would, you know, get to learn everything we need to know about Evergreen, right. See how it really, you know, because you can hear all about an ILS, but then you actually use it and it's different. And also to see how much support will we need? How hard is this? Like how different is life with open source, basically? And honestly, I mean, it's such a good idea. I was really, when I first started, I was like, God, what a good idea to have this, you know, to not just switch over, but to have this time where, you know, the vast, you know, 50 some odd libraries are fine and they're humming along on what they're doing. And then we can have, you know, this, you know, Evergreen training ground, basically. And the libraries that we're working with were coming off of either no system at all. Some of them weren't automated or older, sort of, a lot of them were earlier iterations of Follett, you know, things like that, things that basically don't exist anymore.
Right.
So, you know, anything, they were rarely like, oh, this new system is, I miss our old system because it was so much more sophisticated. I mean, that never happened, you know? So, I mean, sometimes it was like, I miss our old system because I knew how it worked really well. I mean, that I can appreciate, but, so I basically went out and I did, I hung out at our libraries. I did training and I show up on their go live day and I spend the day with them. And, you know, go back after they've been live for a while and, you know, sort of see how it's going and all of that. And then we did our big conversion of all the rest of our libraries, sort of bringing the two consortia together, over Memorial Day weekend. For our big migration, the way we did the training was like a marathon. It was a little bit exhausting. We don't have enough resources. I mean, it's, you know, there aren't that many people in my organization. I think there's 13 of us, you know, so, and just to, you know, I did the training with me and one of my coworkers. So we would do it in pairs,
right.
Sometimes in trios, depending on the size of the group. And we did kind of a train the trainer approach. So what we did was basically 2 weeks, 10 days solid of train the trainer. So we would train two people from each library in each, you know, two for cataloging and then two for circulation. And then they would go back to their libraries and train their libraries. So it's definitely, it was, you know, 10 straight days of just talking. By the end, I remember the last day, like the last hour, I was at a podium and I was just like literally holding onto the side of the podium. Like, this is what's going to keep me upright. So that's that way they went back and trained their libraries. And so now we're, you know, sort of post-migration, you know, working out the kinks, all that stuff. So I do a lot of emailing and spending time on the phone with people. And today my task is to write a bunch of cheat sheets on, different aspects, like things we're getting frequently asked about.
Right.
If for no other reason than so we can stop writing the same emails over and over again, we can just copy paste stuff. Because there's a little bit of that where it's like everyone has this question, and I'll send an email out to everybody and be like, you know, you all have asked this a lot. Here's the answer. But you know, it's still like if it's not relevant for a person right then, they'll often not necessarily read that email or retain that email. And then 3 weeks from now, they'll be like, hey, about that thing, how does that work again? It's like, you know, so it's just easier to have it online and be able to say, here it is. So
what about Evergreen in particular do you think made it appealing? I know that the decision was made before you came on board, but what makes it appealing for consortia?
Well, it was designed, I mean, it was designed obviously by the Pines Consortia, right. in Georgia. And, you know, I think it was designed with that sort of resource sharing in mind. And For most consortia, I mean, every consortium is different. I mean, that's the other thing I've really found. And I had only worked in standalone libraries before this. So my experience with consortia was pretty much that they exist. That was kind of all I knew. And I definitely found that at the Evergreen Conference, I definitely saw a lot of, you know, there are some consortia that, you know, the rules are sort of handed down from the central office and everybody does the same thing and it's very centrally managed. And there are some that are just sort of loose affiliations. There are some that don't even do resource sharing. They just share a system. But for us, I mean, what we needed was, we did go through before Evergreen and unrelated to Evergreen, we went through a rule standardization. There are a lot of libraries in Connecticut on Evergreen and Connecticut has reciprocal borrowing between all the libraries in the state, and that's sort of sponsored at a state level. And even in standalone libraries, you get this a lot. Like people will call up and then say, oh, can you transfer me to the blah, blah, blah library? And I'm like, no, we don't all have the same phone. And, you know, and then they'll be confused as to why all of the libraries don't talk to each other. Like, why can't you look up what I've checked out at some other library? And I used to work at a library that was surrounded by bibliolibraries, and people were super confused as to why we couldn't look up what they had out, let them pay fines, because all of the libraries in the area were connected to one another. And I didn't really understand that we were, like when I worked there, I didn't really understand that all the libraries around me were all in a consortium. So I was always like, why are people constantly asking about this? I don't understand. And then I started Biblio and I looked at the map and I was like, oh, that's why. So they, you know, for most of our patrons, it is sort of a little weird that that everyone does their own thing to such an extent, you know, that everybody has different cert periods and different cert rules and blah, blah. And then some libraries can talk to each other, but others can't. I mean, that's confusing, for patrons. So we, and a lot of our libraries were really finding that. So there was a real push from some of our libraries to do a standardization. So, you know, and in a way it sounds, you know, this is sort of small potatoes, but it ends up being a big deal that, you know, all your regular books go out for 3 weeks and all your new books go out for 2 weeks. So we did sort of standardize on that, although we didn't standardize on renewals or fines, because a lot of our libraries are independent and some of them are city libraries or town libraries, so they can't standardize the fines. So we still needed some level of flexibility to let each library have its own rules and its own, you know, things like its own fines, their own renewals, you know, some level of, like, some of them want their summer reading books to be, you know, a different loan period and no holds, and some of them want them just to be regular books. I mean, all that sort of stuff. So you need that kind of flexibility to have all the rules work for every library, and also to have the resource sharing. The way it works for us is you place a hold and, you know, your book will preferentially come from your library, but could theoretically come from another library. Ideally, we'd be able to say, like, CCAR is our statewide transit system for books, and you'd be able to say, like, you know, these are the routes, here's what they, you know, like, it's easier, there are a bunch of different routes, so it's easier to get books from, you know, library A to library B than it is from library A to library Q or whatever, because, you know, libraries are on the same route, it's easier to get the books between them because they don't have to go back to the central office before they get redistributed or whatever. I mean, I actually have no idea all the details of CCAR, but, you know, I know that that part's true. It's if you're on the same route, things are a little bit easier. And also there's, like, we have a lot of inconsistencies with within our consortium. Some of our libraries get deliveries every day. Some of them get it twice a week. And, you know, all of this adds up to, you know, it would be really great if the system could account for all of that, you know. I have no idea how you do that. I think that part might be impossible.
Did you find Evergreen in general pretty set up like you wanted it out of the box? Did you all have to do a lot of development on it?
We didn't do too much development. The stuff we developed a couple things for our school libraries, hard due dates, so that at the end of the semester they could say, like, anything checked out after this date is due on this date, regardless of which day it was checked out on, you know, sort of end of the semester stuff. And there was something else we developed for them that was similar. I can't remember, but we did two different types of due date development for the schools. And that was, what was great about that was, you know, we got a price tag and we said, well, that's more money than we have. And we put out a call on the open source mailing list, the Evergreen mailing list. And we were like, hey, does anybody else want to do this? And, like, by the end of the day, we had partners and it was done. I mean, and it took, like, a few months to develop. It was not a big deal. And it was really heartening. I mean, it was just sort of surprisingly easy. And we're working on getting a kids catalog developed because that's something our schools and our children's librarians use a lot. That has been a little bit more complicated in terms of getting more contributors and more people to buy into it. And then everybody, you know, it's a bigger project basically. So we're in the middle of that, but, it's honestly, I mean, a lot of the stuff, you know, ILSs are ILSs and I've used a lot of them. So for me, at least I was like, cool, here you go. Works like it should, you know? You know, there's always going to be something that's a little bit different. There's always going to be, well, I used to click here and now I click there. One of the things that seems to be hanging people up a lot is there used to be this check-in damaged mode in Horizon or something. And I didn't use Horizon very much, so I don't really know. But it was like if you had a book that had a hold on it on your pull list and you wanted to check it in damaged so it wouldn't go into the pull list or, you know, it was something that wouldn't fulfill a hold.
Right,
and there
right.
isn't that equivalent in Evergreen. There's a slightly different workflow, and I think that is tripping people. Like, stuff like that trips people up. Because they want the straight sort of analogies, you know, between the two different systems, and that doesn't always work that way. But that's sort of the part that to me is very interesting, is to watch people. I sound sort of like an evil, like mad scientist, like I'm just going to watch people suffer. It's going to be awesome. and I don't mean it that way, but it is interesting to see how people adapt because, you know, your ILS is not your job, nor is it your competency. You know, you can be good at your job and not know how to use your ILS up to a point. I mean, at a certain point, you have to know how to use your ILS. But, you know, I think one of our development partners said it to me sort of best. I said, you know, these are just new buttons. Like, it's okay. You know, it almost doesn't mean anything that you're still learning this. Like, you're learning it and it doesn't mean anything about you that you don't know where this stuff is. I mean, you're going to get there. It's not a big deal long term. It's a big deal right now. And she was like, but I feel like I don't know how to do my job anymore. And I was like, but you do. Like, I don't, you know, it's right. just buttons. But I, you know, I appreciate that feeling. I mean, I, you know, every time I've switched ILSs, it's been like, okay. How do I do this in this system now? You know?
Yeah, well, I mean, because you get the shortcuts down and you know those right. in your head, and then all of a sudden, it's almost like even when my library switched to using the Office 2007, like all this yeah. stuff is so different now. It's like, how do I just select all? I don't even know how to do that anymore. Where is that button?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. But I also think, I mean, it's not just... yeah, it's feeling incompetent when because you don't know where the buttons are and all that, and it is a huge change in workflow. But we also forget, and I think this is really true with Office. I think the Office stuff. We just switched to Office 2010 from Office 2003, and I keep telling our libraries like, no, we feel your pain because like Excel is making us weep right now. The things that we have become used to as shortcuts, that are workarounds that aren't actually right. You know, it's not intuitive. It's not the right way to do it. It's just that we're used to it.
Right.
And we just had a whole conversation about that yesterday about, you know, people keep wanting to check things out to a tech services card when they need to be going to repair or repair card. And Evergreen actually handles that through status. There's a repair status, which is actually like what it is. It's accurate. It doesn't create a false checkout. It doesn't leave patrons thinking this book is checked out for 6 months for some reason. When really it's actually being repaired, you know, all that stuff. Like, it does actually work more, you know, it works in a way that makes the most sense to do it through a status.
Right, but we had created these workarounds
right.
for things we couldn't do with old systems, and we think it makes sense, but that's what I thought about the Office change, is that I'm sure if you're coming into it without using old Office, it makes perfect sense, and it's much more clear how to do things. But it's like, but I know how to do that already. You go
right.
to this menu, to that submenu, to over here.
Yeah, no, that is exactly, and I think that's, you know, there's a lot, like with Gmail, even Gmail, the first time I used Gmail, I was like, labels? The yeah. heck? Where's my folder? Like, I was just like, I don't, and now I'm like, folders are dumb, I want my labels, you know, it's... You know, and that's going backwards. But, you know, when somebody sort of redoes something in some ways from the ground up or with fresh eyes and says, hey, you know, it would make more sense. You know, everyone's going, but we liked the old way because we knew what it was, even though it doesn't actually make any sense.
Told you I was going to ask you about this. Tell me the story about mm-hmm. Hypercat Card Jurassic Park.
Ah, I love this. Okay. Well, so I went to this, my middle school was kind of... technically oriented, let's just say. So we had, you know, like little Mac labs and stuff like that, like all Mac, there were Mac SEs at the time, like the little boxes, and that's how I learned how to network computers. Like
and
we
what,
plugged
what
them together
with
Ethernet cables. Oh, gosh. I was in middle school from, I graduated from eighth grade in 92, and I started there in 89. So I was there from like fifth grade to the middle of fifth grade to eighth grade or eighth grade.
Okay.
So we would like, you know, plug computers together with, you know, little Ethernet cables and stuff like that. Like, so we networks and early, I seem to recall a lot of, one day we had to write a short story of like, or just, you know, write a letter or something, but then accept everything that spell check did. So you would sort of understand the difference between like, you know, don't let the machine tell you what to do sort of thing. You know, especially cause then spell check was, I think that was still in the days of the Cupertino effect and things like that. So our computer teacher had, they taught us about HyperCard. And, you know, I'm in eighth grade. I don't have an address book. You know, I don't have business contacts. I mean, I looked at it. I was like, wow, this would be really cool for grownups. You know, there was a whole component that was like, you could put recipes in here. I was like, that's excellent. I'm 12. Like, you know. I mean, I baked with my parents and sometimes helped in the kitchen. But my role was very much, you know, prep chef. I was not exactly, you know, doing recipes. So I thought that it was neat. But I didn't like understand it like in that gut level, like, wow, I get this way. So then there was this HyperCard ebook of Jurassic Park, and I cannot believe that link you found. You've no idea. I made my day. And I, like I said to you on Twitter, I was afraid to Google it, because, you know, you have these memories of things that were just so mind-blowing and so cool, and then you look it up for real, and it's like, oh, that was dumb, and I can't believe, like, or it just wasn't what you thought it was. Like, it turned out not to be as interesting, or you've embellished the memory somehow, and, like, that happens, you know, that's just human nature. Our memories are pretty lousy. And I was terrified it would turn out to be something completely, like, rinky-dink and silly. And because it had this huge impact on me, there was a HyperCard ebook of Jurassic Park, and, you know, each card is a page, I think. And there were these links. If you clicked on a dinosaur name, it would take you out to a separate card stack about that dinosaur, which was not information from the text of Jurassic Park. It was actually, you know, information from, I don't remember where, I mean, probably encyclopedia or something about these dinosaurs. And that was the first time I really got like hyperlinking and what it could do and all of that. Cause we had talked about that a little bit with HyperCard, and I still was like, what? You know, I mean, I got it.
Like, this is still pre World Wide Web at this point.
right. This is like 92. And I'd been online. I mean, I'd been on, but it was all, I had found a lot of it sort of, and again, I was a kid. I found a lot of it disappointing. Cause like when they said you can get to the Library of Congress, of course I thought, I could see the books. I don't know why. You know, of course, it's ridiculous now, but I just thought that must be what it was.
No, that's what I thought.
And
too.
It was, you know, it was a Telnet catalog, and I was like, but boo, you know. And there were chat rooms and stuff like that, and you could play online games, like, you know, MUDs and whatever. But it wasn't, you know, there weren't pictures and all that. And I liked the sort of chat room aspect of it, because this was before it was, you know, like everyone will die if they go into a chat room. It was pretty, you know. I don't know that my parents knew what I was doing, but, you know, there was nobody, I never had any bad experiences. Nobody was ever creepy. Like, it was fine. Which is not to say, I'm sure people did. I didn't personally. I kept searching the Library of Congress catalog, because I just was convinced that somehow it would let me see the whole text somehow, if I just did it right. I didn't really understand that was not going to happen on Telnet. That was sort of the first, like, I had this, like the light bulb went off. I was like, oh, this is what they've been talking about with linking. This is what that means. And this is how it's powerful. And also I was like, this is amazing. Like, all of our books should be like this. You know, part of me is always sort of looking to recreate that, you know, ecstatic sort of amazed experience.
And it's funny that ebooks are just now almost getting to that point where you're having links out and things like that. I mean, it's really generally, I mean, ebooks are still for the most part just electronic versions of the books. I mean, it's just a PDF basically of the book.
yeah, and that is sort of disappointing. I mean, I want it to be better. I want it to have that blow your mind experience. And I still sort of, I feel like if somebody, you know, updated that HyperCard stack for, you know, a more modern platform, especially because, you know, even as a kid who liked dinosaurs, I was like, wait, raptors, is that like a real dinosaur type? Like I didn't remember seeing that, you know, when I learned about dinosaurs as a kid. And, you know, and even though I wanted to know, like, how much of this is real? Like, is that, right. Is this actually true? Were these dinosaurs like these killing machines, or is this just dramatized for the movie, for the book, you know? And that was, you know, hey, research built in.
I don't know if you saw that the book that Push Pop Press did for Al Gore's last book. They did an iPad version of his book, and it was this amazing thing that had all this video in the middle of it and linked out to all these fantastic things. And they were getting ready to do their own big publishing platform to do this with all kinds of other books. And then the guys got bought out by Facebook. So I don't think it's going
to
happen.
Yeah, I didn't get to see the book, so I don't have an iPad, but I'm disappointed about that. I want more of that. You know,
I think he did a TED talk on it. I think that's where I saw it. But it was fantastic. I mean, it's like you just reach in and kind of it's like Minority Report kind of stuff where you just reach in and grab the picture, pull it out, you know, just swipe it, and it becomes a video telling you about some environmental thing. I mean, it was just fantastic. Everything that the 20 year ago version of you wanted out of ebooks, I think.
I should look that up because I sort of secretly pine for that, I think. Just because, you know, like I said, I keep waiting. I keep waiting to have that, like, you know, the floor just dropped, I'm totally stunned experience.
I always find it funny that just the web seems to still, I mean, it grew so quickly, but it's just now reaching what we kind of had our dreams of when we first heard about it. Like I heard about, you know, oh, the web can show video. I was thinking, oh, we can watch movies and stuff on there. But that's really just now still really coming to be commonplace. Some of that is bandwidth issues, but it's just amazing.
Well, and I mean, going back to what we were talking about with ILS, is part of it is, you know, you sort of, the danger with open source ILS is always that you're just going to reinvent, you know, what we already have with all the same, you know, with all the same workarounds that aren't really, that we think of as normal, but they're actually workarounds. And that's, I think that's true with any kind of, you know, technology, you know, okay, it's the web, or here it's your ebooks. We're just going to make it be, you know, a screen version of what we have in paper. And, you know, and I think it takes a little while to sort of say, all right, what could we actually do with this?
I read one of your blog posts where you talked about the concept of information wants to be free. And I have to join you in my embarrassment that I thought that meant like First Amendment freedom, not cost freedom. I had no idea that until I read your post, and I was like, oh, wow. Is that really what that means? That it's supposed to be no cost free?
Well, I think it's both, but it's just, I mean, we're such librarians, like literally that didn't even cross my mind for the longest time.
No, it never
did
until I read your post. I was like, oh my gosh.
Yeah. I think there are so many, there's so many things like that where, like, you know, you work, at least I find, like, you know, both of my parents are social workers, so I was raised by people working sort of either for government or for nonprofits or for schools. You know, they were always sort of, and, you know, like, it's a totally different way of thinking about things. And I know, like, I'm watching my parents have both retired, and then they have sort of retirement jobs. And, you know, my mom was a school social worker forever and ever, and, you know, worked for the schools where things sort of work a certain way. Now she works in a private practice as a therapist. And, you know, it's a very different, there's just different concern. There's a profit concern, and it's a totally different way of doing things. And she's sort of figuring that out. We talked about it kind of a lot because, you know, I've worked in for-profit companies before library school, but since then I haven't, you know, I've worked in libraries. I work for a nonprofit now. But like literally in our family, I think I have the closest experience. It's 10 years old, you know, and it's like, yeah, like 10 years ago I worked and, you know, I worked for a company like as a, you know, research assistant or whatever. But it is a very different, there's a whole different mindset, and it's not a bad thing. I think it's actually, you know, you need that sort of diversity of thinking, but I was not surprised that it didn't cross my mind, just because it just never does. I'm always like, oh, right, people make money on things. Part of me says, you know, I want to support writers. I want to, you know, I want to support what they're doing. I want, you know, people should get paid for their work, and writing is hard work. And, you know, and all of that. And I knit a little bit. I used to be, when I was first learning, I used to be like a knitting listservs, and there was always a lot of controversy about like patterns and, you know, and if people Xeroxed a pattern, and one person actually said on a listserv that libraries pay more money for knitting books so that you can Xerox them, because then it's free, it's fair use. And like all these librarians were like, what? It was just something totally made up, but kind of like that would be neat if it worked that way, but what? You know, yeah. And she was just like, nope, that's how it is. I'm going to keep Xeroxing from the library. And everybody was like, but no, that's not what? You know, and I not that I've ever made a knitting pattern, but I know people who have. And that's, you know, that's, they should get paid. I mean, they should be paid for their work. But I think somehow, like, the internet has sort of shifted that. Like, not only is, you know, if you see anything that is sort of intellectual work, we've sort of started thinking, like, maybe that should just be free. Like, when you're, like, is that idea that if you're, what you're paying for with the book is the paper, and you're totally not, you know?
Right, right. Like, yeah, that's what a lot of people are thinking now with ebooks. It's like, oh, well, why should we pay anything near what we paid for the price of the book? But it's like, if you actually look at a price breakdown, you can take a few dollars right off because of the physical part of it. But most of it is the editing, paying the author, the, you know, just the copy editing even. I mean, just all this. People that do things in the process to make a good book. I mean, because you see a lot of self-published ebooks, not all of them, but a lot of them, you know, with spelling errors all in them, the grammatical errors, and they're not typeset well, and you don't realize how much you miss that until you get it, that it doesn't have it.
Yeah. Well, and that's, J.A. Conrath spoke at Digipalooza, and he was really interesting. I mean, it was sort of interesting to hear that from a different perspective. He and I forget the other author's name, both had publishing contracts at one point and then weren't making enough money to live on that way. And they ended up going through the Amazon, the self-published, and they priced their books like apps. I mean, like $1.99 and 99 cents, you know, I mean, they're really inexpensive, but they made like $1 billion because, you know, people bought them in bulk basically. And you know, I mean, it's sort of like, I'm happy for this guy to have this success story. I mean, I, you know, I'm not going to begrudge anybody their success, but it was sort of, It was funny to hear him talk about, because he did talk about publishing like it was a cartel. I mean, it was like, you know, yeah, you're you know, getting around the man, and I don't think publishing views itself that way at all. I mean, it's not, you know, and that's not going to work for everybody. I mean, this guy is sort of an unusual, and what's her name, Amanda Hawking,
right? She's the big
has
case.
Actually, yeah, she, I love that, well, now she's, what, St. Martin's or something?
Yeah.
But I love that she's very upfront and seems sort of very surprisingly wise about the fact that she's clearly an exception. You know, this is not going to work for most people. They're not going to, you're not going to make $1 million selling 99 cent ebooks. That's sort of the difficulty about any of this stuff. I mean, you know, Radiohead can release their album for free and still have it work for them, but is that going to, you know, is that just... is that a good model for the music industry, or is that, you know, just because of the, you know, peculiarities of Radiohead's fan base?
Right, and I remember, you know, like 10 years ago or so, I think Stephen King tried to do an ebook, like a serial ebook that he didn't even finish because he was like, I'm not making any money on this at all. I'm losing money by doing this.
Yeah, I remember that. God, I totally forgot about that. That, yeah.
Because he was depending on, I think, people paying him through PayPal or something. I can't remember how it worked now, but it was serialized, and he said, I will keep doing this as long as I'm making money. And he did, like, just a few episodes, and was like, okay, sorry.
Well, and that's sort of a, you know, he's got a huge fan base, but they're probably all thinking, whatever, dude, you're super rich, I'm not going to pay you.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
And
he's like, yeah, the reason I'm super rich is because I get paid.
Right, yeah. Well, and that's, I find that really, like, that perception part really interesting, you know, like what, you know, and some of it is sort of like a justification of, you know, I shouldn't have to pay for this because the people handing it to me have all kinds of money already or whatever. And, you know, I understand there's that, you know, there's always gonna be a little class rage with this stuff, but,
right.
you know, and I get it. I mean, I definitely get it, but I also sort of like, part of me is like, I don't know, my mom taught me not to steal things. Like, you know, that if somebody gives you something for free and they are okay with that, then that's fine. But, you know, you should pay for things. For anybody who has enough, who has any, like, small, even a small amount of expendable income, because then what you're saying is, you know, like, these ebooks are harder to use, but they're free because it's a library and the library's free.
Exactly.
And then, you know, if you're somebody who can afford books, you know, you're going to say, well, heck, these ebooks are easy and they only cost me $10.
They see people, they see Overdrive as being something hard, even though it's free, and they can go, like you said, they can go to Amazon or the iBook store and get the thing with one click.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And you know, free can't be the offset for easy. It can't mean that, well, just because it's free, it's going to be hard to do or whatever. Their big push at Digipalooza was, you know, we're making it better. And I think they're trying really hard to respond to that. But, you know, I also understand they're sort of caught in the middle of, you know, they have to have that DRM there for the publisher. They're very much caught in the middle.
Right now, I don't mean to single out Overdrive in particular. It's just it is much harder to do than to purchase.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And I think that's, you know, Overdrive right now is sort of, they're so the primary vendor for this. So we all cite that as, I mean, I do the same thing. I have a post in the Hopper at TechSource about this, and I realized like halfway through, I was like, I'm pretty much only talking about Overdrive when I'm talking about library ebooks, and I don't mean to. Like, I don't mean to be like, library ebooks are problematic and it's all Overdrive's fault. Like, that's not at all what I think.
I appreciate a lot of what Overdrive's trying to do, they have a really hard, it's really hard to balance what they're doing, so.
Yeah.
I realize they're in a tough position.
Yeah, and they're sort of, because they are the sort of industry leaders for library ebooks, they're the ones that everybody's like, 21 steps, like, rah, because, you know, it's them, it's all them, you know, and that's to some extent, and every, you know, because they are the front runners, as it were.
I don't remember if it was you that said it, or maybe you were talking about Digipalooza on Twitter, but it never clicked with me before that DRM is one of the places that really makes sense for library books to have. I mean, because DRM is always kind of the, oh no, we hate DRM, it's horrible. But it does make sense for library books because you need to add a quote unquote circulation period to it.
Yeah, I don't think it was me, but I think this is an area that's all, DRM is like, it's like Band-Aid, like it's one of those words that we use when what we're actually talking about is, you know, sort of like we're talking about it as if it's a generic, but it's not, you know, or it's actually the reverse of that. There's like types, you know, there's types of DRMs, like there's, you know, and a lot of it is not great, you know, and a lot of it is really problematic. But I would be curious to, like, if there, it could be lighter weight, you know, I get why they want it. I get why they want it to, and you do need it for circulation period. You need something to enforce circulation periods.
Right.
And maybe you don't call it DRM because now that's a dirty word. Maybe you call it something else, but you know, I don't know enough about the technology necessarily. Maybe there's a different way to do that I don't know about. Or maybe we could somehow charge overdues. Like, I just, like, there's no DRM, but if you don't bring it back, 10 cents a day.
Right.
Yeah. But I feel like that would not work. I can't imagine that.
That gets into, oh, well, my file, my computer deleted it.
Right.
So I don't actually have it anymore, but I can't, how do you prove that?
Right. And plus the library I worked at in 2004, 2005, we got both Overdrive and NetLibrary. This is way back when it was first sort of new. I mean, there were no Kindles, no Nooks, nothing like that.
Right.
It's so funny. I'm like 2004, way long time ago, you know, but in terms of the ebook.
Back when dinosaurs roamed the earth.
It's true. And we were making fire in caves. I think I still have my PowerPoints somewhere. I made PowerPoints for the staff to show them how to use Overdrive and NetLibrary. And I kind of want to dig them out because I don't remember how it worked. I mean, back way back then with dinosaurs. I had some patron, and I can't remember who, I don't remember if it was somebody who wanted to use an ebook or he was just asking about ebooks or something like that. It was something, and I was explaining to him how to do the ebook thing and how to download an ebook. And of course it was super complicated and you had to read it on your computer. And he was like, well, why can't I take this one out now? And I said, oh, it's because it's, somebody else has it out. And he was like, but it's an ebook. And I was like, yeah, but like, that's how it works with this. Like they're treated like regular books, and that's, you know, the rule basically.
Yeah. That's and one of the harder conversations to have with patrons.
Yeah. Cause then he immediately got, and I think people kind of get it more now cause they're like, oh, okay. It's like, it's special library technology because ebooks are sort of more common and whatever. But he got super condescending and was like, no, sweetheart, it's a file. Like, you can share it with anybody. And I was like, oh my God. Like, you know, I had that like inner rage. And I was like, take a breath. Don't say anything for a minute. Give yourself a second, you know, because you're going to sound mad. And then I was like, no, I understand. But this is, you know, this is not how it works in this case. There's special protections built into these digital files.
Yeah, I always try to approach it from the other end and say, you know, well, the publisher has decided to put this. It has decided to put this in this situation, so I try to shove it on them instead of onto us.
Well, and that's, you know, with a lot of this stuff and with any of these things, we're so, you know, even like, even your ILS, I mean, any library technology, most of it is not of our own design.
Right.
So, you know, even stuff like, I'm sorry that the reservation software ate your reservation. I can make you a new one, but I can't put you at the head of the line and because the software doesn't let me or whatever. I mean, usually you can, but you know, whatever the restriction is, it's usually something that comes from the software. But you know, people are like, well, why are you doing this? You know, why don't you let me do this? And I think that's a tough position. I mean, for anybody to be in, you know, I'm sure whenever I've worked retail, I'm like, no, the cash register does not work that way. Like, I can't do that. But I think it's less of a problem in a lot of other industries and in libraries because we use so much technology that is from the outside world.
Right.
You know, outside of, you know.
Right. From the positive view of it, people see us as being very technically savvy. But then when we can't do something, they're like, well, but you're the library.
Right, right. And like, why are you on purpose like thwarting me? And it's like, well, sometimes, you know, it is us. Like, no, we don't let you place do renewals or you ran out of renewals or whatever because we don't, you know, we want to have a cap on renewals so you can't renew it online or whatever, you know, your internal rule is.
Right.
Yeah, but it is sort of, but then of course for the person at the front desk who, you know, may or may not have been in on the discussion about whether or not that was the rule or the technology. They're just like, no, I don't know. Like, you can't renew it. like, just give it back.
The only other thing I wanted to ask you about, sort of related to ebooks, well, not sort of related, very related to ebooks, the whole, and Overdrive, the whole HarperCollins Overdrive thing that happened mm-hmm. a while back and is still getting sorted out. There's a lot of working back and forth with publishers, and publishers are controlling the conversation with ebooks as far as libraries go. I mean, what do you think, how do you think libraries can really get into that and contribute to making a solution that works for publishers and libraries?
Yeah, that's, you know, I think I understand why this is a hard question to phrase, because it's like, what are we going to do? Question.
Right.
I think everybody's sort of hung up there. I don't know that there's any one answer. It's almost like, well, what day is it? You know, like,
right.
Then I'll give you a different answer. You know, I think there's been a lot of sort of controversy around the idea of a boycott of HarperCollins. I personally, like, I can't see like not buying their print books because you don't like their ebook policy, which I realize is maybe a little, you know, like, if you're going to boycott them, you should boycott. But I can't, like, just personally, I just think that's, for me, that's too much. But I also think that maybe the word boycott was the wrong word. You know, I think librarians are, you know, we're so driven by what our patrons want. It's very hard to say, this isn't going to work for us as an organization, so we're not going to do it. I mean, that's a very hard thing to say, especially when your patrons are like, why don't you have this on ebook? The saving grace is that there's a lot of stuff we don't have on ebook, because anything from Simon & Schuster, or I think Macmillan, you know, it's not going to be there. So it's, you know, it's not like it's only this one publisher that we're not going to have. So in that sense, you know, that is weirdly, I think, a saving grace of that. But I do sort of in retrospect think maybe boycott was not the word to use, because it sort of, you know, conjures up this image of people like stamping their feet and carrying signs and saying no.
Right.
and I don't think that was necessarily, like, I you know, for me, I mean, it was never about like, let's stand outside their offices and jump things. It was very much like sort of collectively saying, you know what, like if you feel like your library can't afford this, you know, can't afford this model or won't be able to afford this model in the long term, then you don't have to accept it. And if several of us sort of all say together, like, no, this model doesn't work for us, can we please try and come up with something better? So I think less a boycott and more of a no, thank you, let's talk. Because that's what would be sort of the most productive. And I don't necessarily see the let's talk part happening. Although maybe it is, and I just, you know, I don't know what other people are doing necessarily. I think
that was kind of the initial freak out that librarians had, is that in the press release or whatever that they, HarperCollins said, oh, you know, we've been working with librarians and blah, 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 blah. And everybody's like, well, who have you been talking to?
who told you this was a good idea? And certainly a hybrid licensing model is not a bad idea. Like we might need to buy a bazillion copies, e-copies of something when it first comes out, and then we don't need to keep them all. And
right, but that's what we do in print. I mean, when James Patterson comes out with a new book, we buy X number of copies, and then after the initial demand has gone away, we sell those off. So,
right, exactly. You know, and certainly, and everyone I know in libraries has had people come in and say, "Can I donate my ebooks to your collection?" and things like that. You know, people want that sort of. It is a print model, but it's not a terrible model. It's, you know, saying like, you know, here, if it's just a file, I should be able to give it to you, and I should be able to delete it, and I should be able to, you know, all of that stuff. And certainly people rent books from McNaughton and Baker and Taylor and things like that. So I don't have a problem with the idea of a temporary license. I just exclusively as a temporary license with no capacity for ownership makes me uncomfortable.
The whole idea of the first sale doctrine thing has kind of gone away with ebooks.
Yeah, exactly. And that's huge for libraries. I think there are a lot of issues around ownership that still have to be sorted out, especially because that has been sort of the cornerstone of libraries for a long time. And, you know, I know there are people who are saying we're going to have to find something besides ownership to hang our hat on. And I get that. I don't know that I agree with it. I don't know that that's going to work. But maybe it will. And that's, I don't think anybody actually knows. And I really do in a lot of ways feel for publishers. I think it's very easy for us as libraries to be like, we're the little guy and you guys are making, and again, it's that profit motive. You guys are making money. So therefore, and I think there's sort of a martyr aspect to being sort of the tiny nonprofits. And I feel myself drifting that way sometimes where I'm like, well, we're all underpaid and overworked and man, we're not, you know, and somehow this makes our motives pure, I guess, is the, you know.
Right. Unlike you big suits in New York, you publisher.
Right. Exactly. Which is ridiculous because it's, you know, it's not like publishing is, I mean, yes, it's a big, they're not hedge fund people. I mean, they're not like, it's not like they're running around on private planes and stuff. I mean, they're, right. You know, and they're book people like us, you know, they're committed to, you know, and I'm not saying like all publishers are, you know, that you can't say anything. You can't say anybody's all wonderful. I mean, you know, I'm sure we all know librarians we don't like who have bad motives we don't agree with or whatever. But it's we're all kind of on the same in the same boat and we're all kind of dependent on each other. Folks at the Overdrive conference were making very good points about, you know, the connection. It was actually from a publisher making really good points about the connection that libraries have with readers that, you know, is invaluable to the to authors and to publishers and all of that. And Ruth Liebman from Random House was really wonderful in talking about sort of her pro-library stance and how she, you know, tries to bring that to her authors. Like, libraries are really going to help you. Like, they can launch your book in a way that an ad campaign can't necessarily, because so much of where their sales come from is word of mouth, and we're a big part of that.
Right, definitely.
So, you know, I think there is a real, you know, we're certainly dependent on publishers a lot in a lot of ways. I do think it's a mistake to think of them as like, you know, a big giant company that knows what they're plotting of the future of ebooks and the downfall of libraries. And I don't think that's the case. I think it can feel like that because we feel like we have a lack of control in this. But I also don't think that publishers are necessarily, I think they're just as freaked out as anybody else, because this is a huge sea change that, you know, as several people have said to me, and I, you know, this is not a surprising sort of piece of information, but at any point, you know, if Amazon or Apple or you know, any of these big companies comes in and says, you know how ebooks are going to work? They're going to work like this. And if enough people buy into that, like, that's how they're going to work. You know, like, it's not, it's...
Right. I mean, that's basically, that's what Apple did with the music industry, basically. They said, this is how it works now.
Yeah, exactly. And everybody was like, okay. You know, like, it is easy to sort of, and I have something coming out in public libraries. They did a whole section of an issue devoted to the HarperCollins Overdrive issue. And that's sort of my point and my contribution to that is I don't think anybody knows. I don't think publishers know. I don't think anybody is like, okay, here's how it's going to work out. And I think there are a lot of people out there in libraries with really great ideas who are definitely finding a path for their libraries or trying really hard to do so. But I see this now working in a consortium. You know, we have 60 libraries in our consortium. It's really hard to find one size fits all solutions for anything for that many organizations. Just because, you know, we have one of the largest city libraries in the state is in our consortium, and a library with no bathroom, it's so small, is also in our consortium. There's no way they have the same solutions for ebooks. There's just, I mean, maybe, but you know, how they're going to approach this is very different. You know, we have libraries that are buying Kindles and buying Nooks and buying iPads for their patrons to use and borrow and things like that because they want to show that they're keeping up with technology. And then we have libraries that are buying them because they want to help their patrons keep up with technology because their patrons aren't there with ebooks at all or aren't there with these technologies. So they're like, look, it's an iPad. And their patrons are like, I've never seen one before. And then other people who were like, how could you not have iPads? Because we all have them and our children have them. And, you know, and those two types of organizations are going to have very sort of different solutions. I sort of have a hard time imagining something that's one size fits all.
Right. Well, we're all sort of making our way blindly into the future together.
Yeah, and publishers are too. I don't like the 26 circ idea. I'm really uncomfortable with the implication that was in a lot of that, which has sort of dropped off the radar about cracking down on consortial purchasing and group purchasing. There's no way some of our smaller libraries would be able to have, you know, their own, that's how they're going to offer ebooks is through a group, you know, is by resource sharing, by cost sharing. You know, and that sort of has fallen off the radar, and I don't know what happened to that. But you know, I get that they're trying something, and I don't think they're necessary. I don't think it's malicious. I don't think it's any of that stuff. I just they want to try this, and I get that. And I, you know, people, and there are people who are clearly willing to try it. I mean, at the Digipalooza, there was it felt to me like an even divide of people who were like, could you please put the HarperCollins books back in with the regular books? Because it's a pain in the butt to have to do the same search twice because we're buying HarperCollins books because we're fine with the 26 circ thing. You know, and certainly people have said to me, seriously, do any of you, like, check, do our books, how many books really circ more than 26 times? And, you know, and there is sort of that practical aspect to it, although I'm sort of disinterested in that in a way. I'm more interested in let's find something that sort of works philosophically, but also, works practically as well. But I, you know, whether or not a book will actually circ 26 times is sort of, to me, not the point. The point is it will, you know, libraries right now operate on the basis of owning the materials. And if you don't own them, what is a library if we don't own our, you know, what does that mean for us and what does that mean for what we can do? And you know, if it's 26 circs now, who's to say, you know, 6 years from now, they're not going to say, you know what, 10 or 5 or whatever,
right?
You know?
It's sort of taking a stand now for a, like you said, a philosophical point of view.
Right. A better solution that will work for everybody. I mean, I certainly have no interest in eternal ebooks and sort of saying to publishers, I think I should pay, you know, $15 for this book and then get to keep it forever and ever and ever. Like, I, you know, I get that that's not fair. And again, I want authors to make money. They are our friends, you know.
The future is ever changing, obviously. And I mean, in ways things can come into it. I mean, you know, like the iPad is only a year and a half old. The Kindle's only a couple, 2-3 years old. These things just come up and completely overturn the apple cart sometimes. And
yeah,
we have to learn to deal with it. And we do.
Yeah. I mean, that's the black swan not the terrifying ballerina movie, but there's a book a few years ago about that, about, you know, these sort of things you don't see coming until they already happened. And then in hindsight, you're like, well, we totally should have known that was going to happen. And it is in some ways a scary time for libraries. There could be something that comes in and basically just makes us totally irrelevant. I mean, like genuinely irrelevant. Or, you know, what we see happening now is people think we're irrelevant. Of course, we know we're not. And there's all of these fantastic justifications for, you know, and true reasons to have libraries. I mean, there are many ways in, you know, which we are absolutely not irrelevant. But if people think you're irrelevant, you kind of are, I guess. And every time a new technology comes up, there's always like, well, that's enough with libraries now. You know, the internet, I mean, and I'm sure, you know, I sort of like that when people go back and say, well, you know, look at this. Like, there was a huge argument about whether or not libraries should circulate novels, you know, if that was really the place of the library because novels were sort of trashy. Or, you know, there were big arguments about whether or not phone reference was a good idea, you know, and so then, of course, we had to have that argument about IM reference. And, you know, we're always going to have those sorts of issues. And I think that there's always going to be somebody saying libraries are irrelevant. That doesn't make it feel any less, like, just because we've been there before and survived, you know, it doesn't mean that this time we're going to, you know, I mean, this could be it. This could be, I mean, I'm not trying to be fatalistic or alarmist or anything, but I do think there are, I am sort of nervous that there'll be something that it turns out to be the black swan for libraries where we look back and go, yep, that was it. We should have seen that coming, but we totally didn't.
Well, I did like one of your blog posts, I think, was you mentioned something about that libraries need to be a place that people want to go to rather than feel like they have to go to. And I think that's really what we need to push, is that people make people want to come to the library.
Yeah, it's, you know, for a lot of people, we end up being the, you know, broccoli, because, you know, they associate us with homework and all those sort of early memories. And, you know, I mean, a video game collection right there, or a video game program. I mean, just to create that, like, we're not just like spinach for kids as part of that. McDonald's is genius at this. They not the spinach part at all, you know, sort of embedding themselves in people's minds with positive childhood. I don't even eat meat. I don't like McDonald's. I remember the birthday cake we got from McDonald's when I was like 5 or something, I was 7. You know, I remember like the candy and the way it tasted, because I was not allowed to have a lot of junk food as a kid. And it's there as like this, ooh, like this sort of exciting childhood thing that, and you know, I don't want to eat McDonald's, but that's there as part of, you know, and it's embedded for a lot of us in our culture as, you know, this sort of childhood, like you got a Happy Meal and you got to eat these fries and those flavors and those tastes and all that becomes part of your associations with positive memories as a kid. And I mean, they actually, like, they do this on purpose because they know about marketing. And libraries, you know, it's like, go to the library, do your homework, rah, 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 you know. And you know, that replaces the positive story time memories for small kids and then gets sort of entangled with it. So on some level, as adults, you're like, oh, I have to go to the library. Okay, it's no fun at all. So, you know, if a video game tournament can make a kid have a positive memory of the library, that's going to be a taxpayer who's happy to support you, you know?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay. Well, Kate, thank you so much for talking to me for the show.
Thank you. This has been really fun. I am with you. I like interview shows. I enjoy fresh air. I'm always amazed that I will listen to interviews with people that I never knew I would be interested in.
Exactly.
So I think this is such a good idea.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
If you'd like to know more about the podcast, you can visit circulatingideas.com or follow the show on Twitter @CircIdeas. You can also like the show on Facebook @facebook.com/circulatingideas. If you have comments, questions, or suggestions for future interviews, you can contact the show at circulatingideas.mail@gmail.com. Our music is by Pamela Klicka. Thank you for listening, and I hope you'll join me again next time.